accession number 17771, reel 3.
Yes, I was recounting the story of one and the only pilot I knew on the squadron who had a bit of a reputation for bringing his aircraft back, particularly from some of the longer raids. He was also known as Pranger Millard because he managed to write off a couple of aircraft on landing, as I remember rightly. I think in retrospect, I don't think it was so much a morale problem as a guy who was perhaps not a very good pilot. But on the whole, morale was absolutely excellent. I have no knowledge, of course, of what it was like in the very difficult times when losses were severe, but I think the same must have been... Yeah, it must have been the same. I mean, we were all, as I have said already, remarkably young, 19, 20, idealists, and when I say we, none of us wanted to die, but we had no real fear. We didn't look upon it, death as being inevitable, and somehow or other, speaking personally, it simply didn't worry us. I would have hated to have been married. I was, if you like, unattached. My parents were in Australia, or actually in New Zealand at the time, and so I didn't have any responsibility to anybody but myself, and I think that helped amazingly. But the morale in Bomber Command was interesting. Later in my life, I was very much involved in the Staff College, and even after I'd left, I used to go back to lecture, often on the theme of leadership, because I think it was Bomber Harris who, to my mind, was one of the most remarkable men I ever met. I never knew him, of course, during the war. I was just a one of what he used to call his old lags, a very junior member of aircrew. I had been commissioned in October. If you didn't get commissioned out of training, if you had done about 10 operations and were considered to be of the right stuff, then the chances were you were commissioned then, and that's how I got my commission. So I was just a pilot officer by the end of the war. But there was something about Bomber Harris's leadership, which I used to talk about in later years, the antithesis to somebody like Monty Montgomery. Monty was always up front. He was a showman. He went around his troops, and he was a tremendous general and a very great leader. Bomber Harris was something quite different, and for very good reason. He seldom went out to the airfield, and so one seldom, very few of us, ever saw the man. But somehow his personality, his determination, and he got across to us the feeling that if he asked us to do something, it was something that was really necessary to be done. And so we did it cheerfully. Nothing we disliked more was to get one of his famous signals after a raid telling us we'd cocked it up. The reason, of course, that he didn't go around the airfields is he was too busy. Unlike any other general or admiral throughout history, he was fighting a battle almost every night of the life. Every night, Bomber Command, almost, depending on the weather, sent out 300, 400, 500, or 600 aeroplanes, which meant that they were sending out seven times that many people. So, say, up to 7,000 men were being engaged every night in a battle over Germany, and these were all planned, of course, from Bomber Command itself. So he didn't have time to go around and pat people on the back and give people handshakes and all the rest of it. And in that way, one would have thought that he would have been sort of him up there who had no interest in us down here. Despite lecturing on the subject, I have never quite been able to work out how it was that he had this tremendous following. After the war, or sometime after the war, in the early 1970s, the Bomber Command Association was formed. And I think some of the most remarkable occasions that I've ever attended have been the Bomber Command annual dinner, which was held in London. In the 70s, we used to muster somewhere around 8 to 1,000 people at these dinners, which was held in the only room in London that I know would take it, which is the great room at Grosvenor House. And we'd all assemble at our tables, and there was a sort of a balcony around this great dining room, and a sort of a sweep of stairs. And when everybody was assembled, to the broadcast sound of Lancaster aircraft engines, Bomber Harris would walk down these stairs to tumultuous reception. I mean, all the ex-Bomber Command people loved Bomber Harris and felt bitter about the way that he was treated after the war. I mean, outraged, I think, is probably the right word. And we were also disappointed that, unlike any other major action, Bomber Command never received a Bomber Medal. And I think that all upset us. In fact, of course, a private venture actually produced an unofficial Bomber Command Medal, which many of us bought. And you will see today, when aircrew gather together on an occasion where they wear medals, a lot of them will wear this Bomber Command Medal. I was very fortunate, and many years later, in getting to know Bomber Harris personally over the business when I was Commandant of the RAF Staff College, in doing a couple of video interviews. I didn't do the interviewing with Bomber, who was perhaps then in his 80s, but still absolutely as sharp as a tack. And he came and stayed with me at my house. And I thought he was a remarkable man. I mean, one of the things that appealed to me was that I had two quite young sons, sort of 10 to 14, I suppose, who would join us for lunch and got to meet him. And he was marvellous with them. Didn't talk down to them, but enthralled them with his stories and was able to relate to them in a way which I think for an 80-year-old man with somebody else's children was really quite remarkable. And of course, talking to him and watching the interviews of his whole career, he had had a remarkable career in his life, way going back into World War I days. So, I mean, I think he was a very great figure who was very badly underestimated, extremely badly treated by Churchill, who was always one of my, and still is, one of my great heroes, one of the greatest Englishmen that ever lived. Somehow or other, I don't know what happened, but he somehow got the wrong end of the stick about what had happened in Germany. And of course, poor old Bomber Harris has got the stick for doing precisely what he was told to do by the government and by the chiefs of staff. And so I felt that he, and so many of us do, that he was very badly treated. And a lot of rubbish has been produced about the Bomber offensive, without which I don't think D-Day would have been possible, and without which the Russians would have had a great deal more difficulty in winning their battles. People don't understand how many people were tied up in Germany just defending Germany from us. I mean, you could count 2 or 3 million people. People don't also understand that one of the greatest weapons of the last war was this German 88mm gun, which was both an anti-tank and an anti-aircraft gun. Millions of them were diverted from the Russian front to cope with the Bomber Command offensive. What would have happened if the Germans had been able to develop the V1 and V2 weapons uninterrupted by Bomber Command, I just hate to think. It would have been another blitz, but worse, and at a time when we were preparing to invade the continent, because the V1s would have been ready before D-Day instead of afterwards if we hadn't hit Peenemünde. So, as I say, there's a lot of nonsense talked. And somehow people consider civilians being killed by bombs as much worse than being killed by tanks or rifles or anything of that nature. And it's a sort of a moralistic approach which I find illogical and stupid.
Can you tell me more about these famous signals by Harris?
They were quite straightforward. We were, if on any particular night, and once the photographs had been analysed, it looked as though the bombing had been inaccurate, he would merely send a signal telling us that we hadn't done very well and we'd better do better in the future. But we all took it to heart. We didn't like to fail in any way. We had a job to do and we liked to do it to the best of our possible ability. And so we always took those very much to heart. There were not, in my day, very many of them. By that time, I think the bombing was becoming ever more accurate as our various techniques were becoming better refined, as GH, H2S, and various other devices for making the attacks more accurate were brought into force. But yes, we were trying to do the best possible job in the best possible way.
Do Did you ever mention those signals to him when you met him after the war?
Funny enough, I don't actually remember doing so. I did ask him the truth about a lovely little anecdote which was reported about Bomber. It was when he was based, of course, at High Wycombe, and he was the sort of man who very often used to drive himself rather than have a chauffeur. And he was driving back to the headquarters fairly late at night one time, and obviously driving a bit fast, when he got stopped by a policeman. And the policeman sort of came up and started to admonish him and say, "Do you realise, sir, that you might kill somebody if you drive like that?" And he said, "That's what I'm paid to do, young man." And I don't remember whether he said it was true or not. He said, "Oh, it might have been, I suppose." If I was in a hurry, I didn't have much time to stop and chat to policemen. Yeah.
You said that you were all idealists. What did you mean by that?
I was what?
You said you were all idealists.
Well, we felt we were doing something which was worthwhile. I mean, I was fortunate in fighting in a war when there seemed to 99.9% of us no possible doubt who was doing the right thing. And that was before, of course, we ever knew about Belsen, Auschwitz, and the Holocaust. Germany had devised this war, although you could make a very good argument, which I often do, to saying that the Foreign Office was responsible for the war in its appeasement. Appeasement never won anybody a row of beans, and appeasement of Hitler right from the re-entry into the Rhineland had spelt that there eventually was bound to be a war. Hitler could have been stopped dead almost before he started if the Allies, as they subsequently became, had the guts to stop him when it was easy to do so. But by this time, of course, there was no doubt about it. And, of course, during 42 and 43, there was no other way of combating Germany offensively. And you never won a war by being defensive. And it was the Royal Air Force and Bomber Command that took the war to Germany at a time when we hadn't any other resources. By the time I was flying, of course, it was D-Day had been launched before I flew my first operation, and things were very different. But nevertheless, we were very much engaged in paving the way for the breakout from Normandy. Marshalling yards, which had been heavily bombed before the invasion, and indeed helped to stop panzer divisions being able to be rushed quickly to the beachheads. We were still attacking marshalling yards and preventing all sorts of things happening. In particular, the advent, I mean, another thing which Bomber Command prevented was, of course, the introduction of the enlarged numbers of the Schmorkel submarine. By Dortmund Ems Canal was bombed to stop parts assembled submarines being taken up to the ports to be assembled. And I think if the Schmorkel submarine had been able to go to war in any great numbers, we would have had enormous difficulty, particularly at a time when we were bringing over large numbers of troops from America to play their part in D-Day. So yes, we all felt we were doing a worthwhile and important job and had no doubt at all what we were doing. And so that made fighting the war comparatively easy for us.
Going back to the question of morale, did you or any of your brother aircrew officers and NCOs have any superstitions about going on raids, any lucky charms or anything like that?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think a lot of people, I'm not sure that I did. I used to carry my girlfriend's picture and prop it up on the navigation table. That was a sort of fairly youthful, sentimental thing to do. There used to be a sort of a rather peculiar custom that had built up where all the crews used to take their last leak up against the towers of the aeroplane until it was discovered that it didn't do the ersatz rubber or whatever they were using to make towers in those days any good, and we were forbidden to do that. But by and large, I don't think people were, I don't remember people being very superstitious, or if they were, it was not something that they proclaimed loudly.
You said that you formed this gaggle formation. What was it?
Oh, it was just a loose formation of all the squadron aircraft, which were participating in a particular raid. Each squadron had, if you like, a bombing time. And if it was a daylight raid, you would set off, take off over the airfield. You would fly around, say, 3 or 4 minutes while all the aircraft gathered together, and in a very loose formation. There wasn't a vic. It was just a sort of what we call a gaggle, like the geese you see down on the marshes here when they're flying in the morning. They're just a sort of a crowd of them. And then you would eventually link up with other parts of the bomber stream as you flew down England and as you exited out over the coast.
Could you say more about the escorting Mustangs, which you briefly mentioned?
Well, we were, of course, we did a number of daylight operations. The longest we ever did was actually against Nuremberg, and that must have been getting on towards the end of the war. Nuremberg was, of course, I think too far even for the Mustangs, or if there were any about, we never saw them. Although, happily, we were not attacked by fighters on that particular... I mean, I didn't know of any attacks by fighters. But we did a number of Ruhr raids in the end of 44, beginning of 45. One raid, which was well over 1,000 aircraft, I remember, on Essen. And then we would see, probably on Essen, there were other aircraft apart from Mustangs, because that wasn't too far away. We would be briefed at the briefing that they would be in the area, and we used to see them sort of rolling around in the sky not too far from us, and that always gave us a great sense of comfort. But the number of daylight raids, I suppose, of that nature we did were very few and far between. I probably did 4 or 5 in all out of the 28 operations that I did.
What do you feel now in 1998 about having taken part in the Second World War?
I'm extremely proud of it. It was a war we had to fight. And I was always grateful that I was trained in the UK and was on an operational squadron for nearly a year of the war, whereas I might not have made it. And I think I would have been very frustrated if I had ended the war having done nothing but train in Canada or South Africa or something like that and got back too late.
Now, can we jump ahead to the late 40s and the Berlin airlift, and can you tell me what your job was then, please? Mm-hmm.
Not long after the war, we spent the first weeks after the war dropping bombs in the North Sea. They were largely, I think, American-made 1,000-pound or 500-pound bombs, which were considered unsafe, or the Americans didn't want to take them back over across the Atlantic. So we did that for quite a long time. Had a lot of fun doing it, I remember, because we indulged in a lot of low flying. We used to do what we used to call bomb Tokyo attacks over the coast. It was not the famous Doolittle raid on Tokyo, which had been on an extremely low level, had captured our imagination. So we used to drop these bombs off the coast and then scream in over Billington at a very low level. In those days, people didn't mind too much. The Air Force had pretty good reputation among the local inhabitants. But then after a few weeks, we flew our Halifaxes away, landed them at various airfields in England. I remember landing a Halifax at a place called High Urkel in Shropshire, where there were rows of Halifaxes. One of the sad things was that until recently, when a Halifax has been cobbled together, despite over 5,000 being built, there wasn't a whole Halifax left in England. I mean, as soon as we'd landed and clambered out, somebody with a great chainsaw came along and started to cut it up. And then a few days later, the first of our new aircraft, if you can call them that, were landed. Stirling Mark Fives. The Stirling, of course, had been the first of the four-engined bombers. It had not been a great success because its ceiling was low, and it was, compared with the Lancaster, fairly slow and ponderous, and it had been sent on to other duties. My brother-in-law, who was an Australian, was on supplying the Marquis in France and then supplying our troops at Arnhem. But the Mark V was ostensibly a troop-carrying aeroplane, And we were delivered those in, I suppose, it must have been May, June of 1945. And depending on the crew's experience, you either stayed on Stirlings in a transport role, or those with less experience went on to the twin-engine Dakota and were probably posted to India or the Middle East. But my pilot was experienced, and so, or relatively speaking, and so we stayed on the Stirlings and then started to fly out to India and the Far East, carrying initially Indian troops back to India and British troops back again. Extremely uncomfortable. This was a bomber aeroplane, and we used to put about 30 to 40 troops on board. Happily, the Stirling didn't last very long. It seems rather strange, but bomber aircraft had a toilet down the back, which merely exited it out of the back of the aeroplane. And with a crew of seven on a sortie, the chances were it might not be used at all. But if you had 30 or 40 troops doing 8 or more hours out to Egypt and Palestine and India, it got a lot of use. And what subsequently was discovered, that the urine had been sprayed onto the elevator actuating rods at the back of the aeroplane with subsequent corrosion. So all the Stirlings in late 1945 were grounded, and we were gradually got the York, the Avro York, which again was a most remarkable aeroplane. It was a Lancaster's wings and engine with a new fuselage packed on underneath it. But for an aircraft of that type, it was remarkably successful and a great aeroplane to fly. I must have done 1,500 hours on the York by the time I finished. Well, as I said, we were engaged on flying either troops or passengers or freight to all corners of the globe until in June 1948. I was with 59 Squadron at that time at Abingdon near Oxford. And we were getting ready to go out on one of our scheduled, we used to do about one trip a month out to Singapore and back, getting ready for my next trip, and we were told we weren't going on that, but we had to fly to an airfield in Germany called Wunstorf near Hanover. What had happened, of course, was that a week or so before, the Russians had closed all the land access to Berlin. And so we tore off, really unprepared or unknowing what was going to happen very much, and flew to this airfield at Wunstorf, which was already inhabited by two Vampire fighter squadrons and the odd Dakota. And then we were briefed and sent to Gata with a load of something on board, I don't recall that. And so that continued for the first few weeks. Very haphazard, but as soon as your aircraft was loaded, off you flew to Berlin, landed, offloaded, and then flew back to base again. It was summer. The days were long, and we only flew to begin with by day. And on some days, we'd actually complete 5 round trips to Berlin. It wasn't very long, of course. It was about 50 minutes there and 40 minutes back. But of course, more and more aircraft were arriving as all the Yorks were pulled off the routes. The Dakotas were moved away to another airfield, and eventually, and happily, the fighters were sent away because, to start with, we were occupying the attics with 60 of us living in one attic, which wasn't the best way. But once they got rid of the more regular squadrons, we were in the comparative luxury of 3 or 4 to a room. And then as more and more aircraft arrived, of course, the Americans were bringing them in from as far afield as Alaska and Hawaii, mainly C-54s. So, of course, the whole thing had to be more properly scheduled. And then we moved on to, it was really like becoming a train driver, I suppose. We all had our slots. All the aircraft, the C-54s, the Dakotas, eventually the Hastings, which were just being introduced into service, and the Sunderlands all flew at different speeds. So they had a wave system whereby there'd be 20 or 30 aircraft of one type would have A block time to fly into Berlin, and then the next lot, and then the next lot. You had a special route things called Eureka beacons. It was a radar beacon had been stationed along the route, and you had to arrive at the last one plus or minus 30 seconds, because in good weather they were landing aircraft every 3 minutes, and in between the landings they were also taking other aircraft off. So there was a movement out of Gatow in good weather every 90 seconds. If you failed to make your first approach for whatever reason, you merely flew straight back to base with your load. There was no provision for anybody to join into this constant stream of aeroplanes. And we were by this time flying right round the clock. And so you, and by this time everybody was pretty tired. But we were then reduced to only two sorties a day. So you would find yourself on a morning, an afternoon, an evening, or a late night block, and you would fly two sorties, and that was that. In the early days, too, of course, the logistics hadn't caught up with us. We'd been moved to Germany without any ground crew. Well, we carried a couple of mechanics on board. The supply system hadn't got into line, and so there were a lot of unserviceabilities, mainly among minor equipments. So to begin with, providing you had four engines that worked and a radio, you flew, and a compass, you flew. And you just, it was just bad luck on all the other things that you didn't have. We weren't using the sort of radar system to begin with, so it didn't matter if our radar wasn't working. But eventually, of course, all that locked into place, and it became an extremely complex and an extremely well-organized system. And so you would fly